You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. For radio listeners across the country and around the world who do not live within earshot of a community or a Pacifica radio station, the media landscape can seem quite lacking at times when it comes to the dissemination of progressive anti-war voices and viewpoints. Until now, one solution has been to listen to programs like Peace Watch and Democracy Now! Over the Internet. For those listeners less technically adept, there was Radio for Peace International, a UN-affiliated station broadcasting worldwide on shortwave from its headquarters on the campus of the University for Peace in El Rodeo, Costa Rica. But now the station is in trouble, and it's reaching out to its listeners around the world in a desperate plea to keep it from being evicted. Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian spoke this afternoon with James Latham, Radio for Peace International's general manager.
On July 21st, we were handed a letter that said that we were to remove our things, our equipment, as well as ourselves from the buildings that RFPI occupies. These buildings were built by Radio for Peace International. They were handed to us by an official of the University for Peace, and at the same time, other individuals, officials, went down to the gate that leads into the radio station, and they had placed a large chain and a lock on it, which blocked our entry to get into the station.
Speaking to the media, one of the reasons the university has given for their action is that the station owes $14,000 for the installation of telephone and internet equipment.
The equipment, it's a local area network equipment that was installed in the university system in 2000. Because I think of our semi-autonomous state, we were asked to pay for it. But before we were able to pay that back, before they even asked us to pay the amount back for the equipment, we were asked to move months before, and we found that ironic because this equipment can't be moved. It's part of the station now. It's it's run through the walls and is all wired up. So at that particular point in time, we were in a bit of a quandary as far as what to deal with this, because if they wanted us to move, you know, we didn't want to pay for some equipment that is going to be left behind for them to use. It didn't seem to be the logical thing. So we never could agree on exactly the terms for that that amount. We understand that it is a debt we will be willing to pay for it. It doesn't look like we're going to be able to do it in an in-kind basis at the moment. We're willing to give the equipment back. It has not been useful to us at all for many years now, it seems like, because of the cutting of the high-speed internet connection, which occurred, I guess it's been about a year.
The other justification the university has publicly cited is that your station is broadcasting on illegal frequencies. Radio for Peace is broadcasting on these bands in violation of certain domestic laws there in Costa Rica set by the National Radio Control Authority, that you're broadcasting on two different bands that are reserved for mobile land communications and for aeronautical use.
Well, those bands, if you look at them, let's use the 7 megahertz band as an example. The 7 megahertz band that we're transmitting on has something on the order of 100 other radio stations, of other radio transmissions on that band. That is used for, I think it's land mobile use. But these are shortwave broadcast stations that are using that, just as we are. There's even other licensed Costa Rican stations on those frequencies. There's a station in Cahuita, Costa Rica, on 7375. So we're in with a lot of company in using those bands. It's not an unusual situation. It's very common practice. The Voice of America is there. About four or five other U.S. stations are there. Radio Marti is in there. All those stations are in there as our neighbors in that same band that they're saying is not to be used by shortwave broadcasters.
So it seems like this is being selectively enforced.
It does. I mean, I would have to say that this is somebody that is speaking, you know, on behalf of the University for Peace, and is kind of slanting it and being very selective as far as the enforcement of it. So, you know, I think that this is just window dressing for, you know, hiding the real reason for the request for us to be moved.
And what do you think that real reason is?
I think it's a divergence in the ideology of the two organizations. We haven't changed our political stance. We still believe in peace and social justice. That's a major thing that we've always worked on, environmental causes and things. I think that the University for Peace has changed, and through this last administration, their focus is much more on peace and security. And I think that if you consider the top people in the University for Peace administration, they're from the business world. They're not people that are from the activist world or social justice area. These are people who have worked with the globalization movement, worked with the World Bank, the World Economic Forum, and I think that the radio station, I'm a firm believer in what it has done, has taken a very critical look at that globalization movement that is going on the planet today, and we have looked at the social consequences of such action of the globalization movement, and so I think that we're being targeted because of that.
I take it you're speaking specifically of University for Peace President Maurice Strong.
Yes.
Yeah.
Maurice Strong and Martin Lees, the second in the chain of command at the University for Peace, have both been involved with this. But in particular, Maurice Strong has sat as the advisor to the World Bank president, special advisor. And has also been one of the founders, I believe, of the World Economic Forum, and has been very involved. He's been president of large oil companies. He has done a lot of large international business, and I think that's a different focus for the University for Peace, where we've always had people who were academics.
Can you speak a bit about the importance of, that you feel RFPI's broadcasting services and how much of a loss it would be for listeners if it closed down?
I think that the frequency spots on the shortwave dial where RFPI occupy, they're the only spots there that are really occupied by a progressive voice on international shortwave radio. Unfortunately, a number of other stations are quite reactive in their political stance. They're far right. We have a host of other stations out there that are ran by governments. I think to eliminate Radio for Peace from that dial is to quench the only progressive voice, to silence it, is going to be a tragedy. The loss of a Pacifica-type station from the short ways is going to be just a tragedy for many people, I think, who rely on the station to get this news, this particular type of very insightful and accurate information from a host of programs.
What are you asking concerned listeners to do to support you in your plight?
We have a campaign, a letter-writing campaign going on where the listeners are being encouraged to write to the General Secretary of the UN, Kofi Annan. All this information can be found on our website, which is www.rfpi.org. www.rfpi.org. And so far, it has been a fairly reasonable outpouring of letters that have gone in. We haven't heard anything back yet from the United Nations, but I think we need to keep that pressure up. I think that this is part of a struggle that is ongoing. We need more progressive voices out on the airwaves, and I think our job ahead is to not reduce ourselves in numbers, but to try to increase. And it is an ongoing struggle and something that we have to continuously work on.
James Latham is the general manager of Radio for Peace International. He spoke with Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian. Representatives of the University for Peace were unreachable for comment due to telephone difficulties in Costa Rica. RFPI is urging concerned listeners to contact UN Secretary General Kofi Annan via email at annan@un.org. That's annan@un.org. Last Sunday, Koreans celebrated the 50th anniversary of their armistice, which brought the Korean War to an end. The Korean War is often called the Forgotten War. But among Koreans, the Vietnam War is, by contrast, a virtual footnote in history. About 320,000 South Korean soldiers fought alongside more than 1.5 million U.S. troops during the 8-year Vietnam War. But public consciousness of South Korean involvement in that war is just beginning to surface. That's due in part to a growing movement in that country to apologize for some massacres of Vietnamese civilians by South Korean combat soldiers and efforts by Korean Vietnam War veterans to seek redress for Agent Orange exposure, which they say has made them ill. In this last of our 5-part series to commemorate this anniversary of the Korean Armistice, Peace Watch presents this report from Nak Win and Inji Khan in Seoul, South Korea.
About 30 Korean Vietnam War veterans held a sit in protest last week in a park near the White House. The veterans delivered a letter to President Bush asking him to order U.S. companies Dow Chemicals and Monsanto, the makers of Vietnam wartime Agent Orange, to compensate the veterans for exposure to the defoliant. The U.S. military dumped 20 million gallons of Agent Orange on the terrain to clear jungle cover. About 80,000 Korean veterans are believed to be suffering from health problems due to exposure to Agent Orange. Lee Suman is head of the Vietnam Agent Orange Korean Veterans Association. The group is currently suing Dow Chemicals and Monsanto in Korea's court system. Lee says back in 1985, the companies agreed to pay $240 million to compensate American soldiers for exposure to wartime Agent Orange, and they've also already paid soldiers from Australia, New Zealand, and Thailand. Lee, who fought in Vietnam between 1969 and 1972, says none of the soldiers knew the risks of Agent Orange.
뿌렸다는 살포했다는 것이 입증되는 거죠. 근데 그 미군들도
Even U.S. soldiers didn't know about Agent Orange in Vietnam. In one example, the soldiers put Agent Orange in their helmets and then they just spread it with their bare hands on the fields to get rid of the grass. They used their bare hands because they didn't know anything about the impacts.
전혀 몰랐던 거죠.
Lee says a third of the Korean veterans died from Agent Orange exposure after the Vietnam War, compared to about a tenth of American soldiers. He says Korean troops were stationed in the most dangerous war operations. The South Korean troops were soldiers for hire. The U.S. saved about $8,000 per soldier per year. Using Korean soldiers to fight in Vietnam saved the U.S. government $2.5 billion, but South Korea received about $1 billion, plus the promise of military and diplomatic help from the U.S. The money gave South Korea a big economic boost at a time when it needed money to rebuild the country. Han Hong-gu is a professor at Seonggonghae University. He's part of the public campaign to apologize for alleged atrocities committed by Korean soldiers in Vietnam. He says that's important as Koreans are seeking apologies and reparations for crimes committed against them.
They distorted the colonization, invasion, and the war that the Japanese broke out, we criticized it a lot, but we did the same thing. Of course, what we did in Vietnam was smaller in scale, but even if we do not intend to provide sincere apologies to the Vietnamese people, how can we ask to the Japanese government or Japanese right wing to apologize to us, to compensate for us. So it was a kind of self-reflection.
3 years ago, Hangyore, a prominent progressive newspaper in Seoul, started receiving letters from Korean veterans who said they felt guilty about killing innocent Vietnamese civilians. The newspaper launched a campaign to apologize to Vietnamese and promote knowledge of the mass killings. This is music at an event to raise money to build hospitals, schools, and a peace park in Vietnam. But not all Korean veterans support the campaign. 2 years ago, about 4,000 veterans attacked Hangyore newspaper in an attempt to stop the campaign. Jung Kyung-jin is with the Korean War Veterans Association.
Communism was expanding in Asia. If U.S. soldiers didn't attack Vietnam, Thailand, Indonesia, and the Philippines would be communists, so we prevented that from happening.
Korean Vietnam veteran Kim Young-man says he understands why some oppose the campaign to apologize to the Vietnamese. He doesn't want to persuade individual veterans. He wants the South Korean government to officially apologize for past wrongs.
We had the pride of joining the war for a long time. That's why most veterans exaggerate or boast their veteran war experiences, rather than say the war is fundamentally wrong and we did something wrong there.
The organizers plan to build a peace museum in Vietnam and a peace park in Seoul. The first contributions to the fund came from two deceased former comfort women who understand the importance of healing past wrongs. The organizers also produced music like this song. The kids are singing, "Please Forgive Us, Vietnam." For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Eun Ji Kang with Not In, in Seoul.
As the nuclear threat of North Korea looms on the horizon, activists will gather this weekend in Omaha, Nebraska, for a weekend anti-nuclear conference. Chris Strom of the D.C. Independent Media Center spoke recently with one of the organizers of that conference, Cindy Azrier of the group Citizens Against Weapons of Mass Destruction.
We're sending out an international distress signal, SOS. It's called Speak Out at STRATCOM, No New Weapons of Mass Destruction. It's going to happen in Omaha, August 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, the weekend, and there'll be a full weekend of events against Bush's and Cheney's plan for new nuclear weapons.
What's the impetus for organizing this event?
That Cheney, several months ago, called a secret meeting at STRATCOM, the Strategic Air Command in Omaha, Nebraska, to discuss the development of new nuclear weapons, which are these mini nukes, or also called bunker busters. They're supposed to be smaller nuclear weapons, but not only is the meeting to talk about the planning of these weapons, which is going forward, with or without the money. I mean, they are planning to do it, and they are determined that they are going to get the House to support this. It's also to talk about the strategy to market them and what they can call them to promote them, to get around the international weapons, nuclear weapons treaties, trying to convince the American people to support this, that these weapons are not dangerous. And, of course, their plan is to blur the line between conventional warfare, conventional weapons, and nuclear warfare. Their plan is to use nuclear weapons and start using them in their arsenal as a standard procedure in all further wars or even for their defense, what they call defense, which we know is actually probably more aggressive than defensive.
What do you want people to do?
We are having this 3-day event where, first of all, we're also commemorating the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and we want people to come out and join us for that. There's a delegation coming from Japan of Hiroshima and Nagasaki survivors. So we're starting Friday night off with lantern float at the Jean Leahy Mall, where we'll be doing a commemoration, and then everyone will be lighting candles and floating them on the river in boats. We will be doing Saturday, we will be having an all-day event, starting out with workshops and educational forums at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. Different groups from around the country are sponsoring workshops. And then on Saturday afternoon, we will be having a large rally in the largest park in Omaha, Nebraska. We had a little trouble getting the permit, but we've got it, and we have permission from the general to do this. We are not promoting civil disobedience or violence, but we will be doing some action, and we will be doing a fake weapons inspection of the Strategic Air Command. Because, as you know, the whole reasoning behind going to war with Iraq, or what the Bush administration used, the rhetoric they used to sway the people, was to get rid of weapons of mass destruction. But we only have to look at the United States to find out that we're the largest holders.
And the Congress just approved the Pentagon's budget for the next fiscal year, which is at about $365, $370 billion. So what does STRATCOM do?
STRATCOM is where the nuclear weapons decisions are made. It's the second most important strategic military planning point in the United States after the Pentagon. So they, of course, get a large chunk of the budget. President Bush flew there after the terrorist, quote-unquote, terrorist attacks of 9/11 and hit out. It's a place that has a large chunk of the military's budget. And I think that many people think they can come and have this very safe meeting in the Midwest where they'll be able to discuss these ideas without any controversy or any protests, and they're going to be for a big surprise. We're hoping for, 10,000 people to be at this protest.
What do you hope comes out of it?
Well, we've already received international media attention for this. There's a story in the London Times recently about this, and we think that obviously we have people aware of it internationally. I think what's most important right now is to raise the issue nationally. I think people from other countries, Europe specifically, are much more aware of what's going on here. So we want to raise awareness and then, of course, have people urge the Congress people to not support this. It'd be great to cut down the military budget, but I think an even more pressing priority is to say, we absolutely do not want to resume nuclear testing. We do not want the development of new nuclear weapons, and we do not want to continue to increase our military arsenal. And we obviously do not want to start using nuclear weapons and therefore blur the line between conventional and nuclear weapons.
Cindy Azrier is an activist with the group Citizens Against Weapons of Mass Destruction. She spoke recently with Chris Strom of the D.C. Independent Media Center. For more information, you can visit the group's website at www.sos2003.com. Amidst the questions left unanswered by the recently released Congressional Inquiry report on 9/11 and vague answers about Iraq's missing weapons of mass destruction are questions stemming from secrecy surrounding the USA Patriot Act. These latter questions beg another, more operable question, namely, should the government be allowed to insulate itself from judicial scrutiny and constitutional challenge just by making its constitutional violations secret? The American Civil Liberties Union says the answer is no. In a lawsuit announced Wednesday, they moved to carry out this belief by representing clients who've been harassed in a variety of ways by the FBI under the Patriot Act. From Pacifica Station KPFT, Renee Feltz has this report.
Reflecting the general public's desire for analysis of the Patriot Act was a crowd who filled a Houston-area lecture hall at Montgomery College this week. They were there to hear a distinguished panel discussion on the necessity and merits of the Patriot Act. Panelist and United States Attorney Michael Shelby spoke in favor of the act. He explained that in addition to information sharing, the act provides the power to pursue terrorists with the same vigor used against narco traffickers in the drug war.
It brought the surveillance laws out of the dark ages and into the 21st century in the same manner that those laws are applied in drug context and in all other criminal surveillance. And that's critical. Because prior to 9/11, the surveillance laws that were involved in national security matters were tremendously restrictive, far more so than if you were out dealing narcotics. If you were dealing narcotics in this country, you were subject to roving wiretaps, if we had probable cause to prove that. You were subject to intense surveillance of your pagers and your internet and things like that. All of the means of communication that drug dealers used to conduct their business, those things could be intercepted by federal law and federal policy, but not so in the area of terrorism.
U.S. Attorney Michael Shelby's co-panelist, who claimed to be in, quote, full agreement with Shelby's position, was FBI Supervisory Special Agent for the Houston Division, Steve Gentry. Special Agent Gentry said 9/11 attacks could have possibly been avoided if channels of information sharing had already been in place. From an investigative standpoint, Gentry described the effects of the Patriot Act on his work.
From a user perspective, from an individual assigned to ensure that every single threat is resolved, regardless of what it takes, okay, time-wise, investment-wise, resource-wise, it's a godsend. It is not giving me new exotic tools that I have not had at my disposal for years. It simply sanctions the ease and the ebb and flow of information, makes it more practical. These cases may go on for years and years and years. And I've personally been to the secret court doctor, and I've personally acquired hundreds of FISA warrants. Okay? If we've got a case that's going on for years and years and years, that's a clue. We hit these things, we resolve them, we knock them down.
The National American Civil Liberties Union has a much more critical analysis of the Patriot Act, describing it as a law enforcement wish list, previously rejected by Congress, some of it rejected repeatedly. Wednesday, the ACLU filed the first ever direct constitutional challenge to the Patriot Act. National ACLU staff attorney Jamil Jaffer explains why the lawsuit focuses on Section 215 of the Patriot Act, one of its broadest provisions.
The section essentially allows the FBI to go to any organization at all and demand that it turn its records over to the government. It doesn't require the FBI to show probable cause or any reason to believe that the person they're targeting has done something wrong. And the organization that's ordered to turn its records over can't tell anyone else about it. They're gagged permanently from ever mentioning the fact. The Attorney General was questioned about the provision a couple months ago before a congressional committee, and he said that the FBI could also use the provision to get genetic information. So there's really an almost unlimited number of ways in which the FBI could use this provision. So that's what we challenge today in federal district court in Michigan.
Alongside the announcement of the ACLU's new lawsuit came the release of its new report on the FBI's radical expansion of powers under the 2001 legislation. Again, attorney Jamil Jaffer.
The Patriot Act got rid of that limitation and allows the FBI to investigate even people whom the FBI has no reason to believe are doing something wrong. The FBI could use a provision to investigate anyone at all, including you and me. It doesn't have to be a foreign spy. It doesn't have to be an international terrorist. It could be ordinary people. This kind of provision casts a real chill on people's willingness to speak out against the government, to disagree with government policy. And that's one of the reasons we're challenging it, because we don't think that ordinary Americans should live under this kind of chill. We think that people should feel free to speak out against the government, feel free to worship as they want to, feel free to associate with whomever they want to, just as the First Amendment says they should be allowed to do.
In its legal challenge of the Patriot Act, Section 215, the ACLU is representing six clients. Two are national civil rights organizations, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee and the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Also represented are the Muslim Community Association of Ann Arbor, Michigan, and the Islamic Center of Portland, Oregon, both of which run mosques and schools. The final two organizations are ACCESS, an immigrants' rights and social services organization in Michigan, and Bridge Refugee Services, based in Tennessee, affiliated with the Church World Services and Episcopalian Migration Ministry. In collaboration with Eric S. Thompson. From KPFT in Houston, Texas, I'm Renee Feltz for Pacifica's Peace Watch.
Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T. from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance this evening from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA, Jabari Zakia, and Robert West. It's your financial support that makes Peace Watch possible, so we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.